destruction to function. Justice for the human family, we demand it. Justice, truth, freedom, equality's a must. Us decolonization of the planet, so bust this. People be the power, now we build the justice. Pouring ancestral divinations, how we build the justice. Welcome the planet to the podcast, build the justice. Build the justice, build the justice. Build is to add on or do away with justice.
Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. My name is Manuel Barajas, a professor of sociology and co-founder of CRISHI. And I'm here with Dr. Ann Lopez, who is the founder of the Center of Farmworker Families, and who will be talking about why don't farmworkers' lives matter. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge the land on which Sacramento State resides. Sacramento is located on the indigenous lands of the Miwok, Meitu, and Nisenan people. We honor their struggle for a better future in a world that has been impacted by colonialism and that has stolen, exploited, and destroyed human lives and environments. In solidarity with indigenous people across the Americas, we hope this podcast provides you knowledge and motivation to collaboratively work for social and environmental justice. Welcome, Dr. Ann Lopez. Can you share with us a little about who you are?
Thank you for inviting me to be with you today. I'm very happy to be here and to enlighten people about farm workers and their struggles. As far as who I am, I'm the director of Center for Farmworker Families. We incorporated in 2012 as a nonprofit, and I got into this business after doing a PhD in environmental science at UC Santa Cruz, and I studied the impact of the North American Free Trade Agreement on the farms in West Central Mexico, and I learned a lot about neoliberal capitalism, and NAFTA, of course, represents the quintessential trade agreement in the neoliberal economy, which is based on deregulation, privatization, getting rid of public services, and if people can't make it in the economy, you blame them. And of course, we see that both with the homeless populations and also with farm workers. And as far as deregulation goes, I found out very recently that 80% of Americans who have been tested have glyphosate or Roundup in their urine. So that means most of us in this country are carrying this herbicide, which is implicated in many cases of cancer, specifically non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in our body. And of course, farm workers are almost continually exposed to this. Farm workers also are blamed for coming here, for wanting to seek a better life, for not following immigration laws, all kinds of blame. And once they get here, we think we have about around 400,000 farm workers in the state. However, we can't know really, because we know that 60 to 83% of them are undocumented and were forced off their farms in Mexico by NAFTA to come here as what I call economic refugees of NAFTA. And when they get here, they live with poverty, poor nutrition, unhealthy living environments. They have no health insurance. Their houses are crowded. And Rick Mines up at UC Davis claims that they'd be much healthier if they just stayed in Mexico, that the longer they're in California, the sicker they get. So learning all of this, I recall very vividly typing the last page of my dissertation in 2002 and sitting sitting at my computer and having a sort of epiphany, because I had planned to go to a four-year institution, continue teaching. I have a long teaching career at the college level and doing research. But what I realized after finishing the dissertation was that I needed to do something about this. And out of that came the Center for Farmworker Families. And one of our main goals is to inform the public of the unjust circumstances of this population of people on whose lives most of us are absolutely dependent. Without farm workers, the entire industrial food system would collapse.
Wow. So essentially, the people who feed the state, the nation, they remain in very impoverished conditions.
Yes.
What chains them to the fields?
There is a concept called agricultural exceptionalism that keeps farm workers from having the advantages that were bestowed on workers from the National Labor Relations Act, also the Fair Labor Standards Act. And what I've observed over my years of study is that just about everything is done to keep farm workers in these slave-like conditions. A case in point is the 50-mile regulation in the state's 24 migrant camps. It was policy and a regulation in the past that when farm workers came to the camp, usually in April, they could get a unit to live in. It's the only decent, affordable housing available to them that I know of, at least in the area of Santa Cruz County. And then they would have to leave by the end of November. But the key is that they would have to move at least 50 miles away. Now, by doing this and taking their families, their children would have to go to at least two different schools. And over time, of course, the children would fall further and further behind in their studies and then eventually drop out. And in Santa Cruz County, that meant that they themselves would become farm workers, or they would join the gangs in Watsonville. And I and a couple of attorneys and other people decided this was unacceptable. We worked 9 years to get rid of the 50-mile regulation and finally got rid of it about 3 years ago. I have asked in Sacramento on numerous occasions and trips, what is the purpose of the 50-mile regulation? And no one to date has given me an answer. And I learned recently that they're going to rescind this regulation pause, basically, in January 2024. So we're working with Ana Caballero and Salinas to get it reinstated. So this is one example of keeping farm workers, quote, in their place and keeping their children from becoming educated. And almost every farm worker I've ever talked to wants nothing more than their kids to become educated and out of farm work. So basically, we're stealing this opportunity from them with the 50-mile regulation associated with the migrant camps. And there's many more of these types of regulations. And I think it all stems back to the South and slavery. When California was destined to become a slave state. And then with the Emancipation Proclamation, it was no longer legal to own human beings like the plantation owners did. So rather than have to own human beings, you create all these laws, policies, regulations, exceptions, et cetera, to keep them in their place and from which escape is nearly impossible. And so you ask why farm workers are in the bad situation they're in. We need them in that situation in order to maintain a farming system that it in itself is unjust, unsustainable, and is basically a failed system. If you look at the players in the current farming system, industrial farming system, starting with farm workers, I mean, they're at the bottom of the heap. They're getting the worst end of the deal. But even the growers in the neoliberal economy, if they start growing strawberries in Taiwan and they're cheaper than the ones that are grown, say, in Santa Cruz County, where we have a huge strawberry industry, then Taiwan can send their strawberries over to Watsonville and undermine the growers' source of income and put the grower out of business. So even the growers would have a hard time in this economy. And if you look at the consumers, none of us know what we're eating on our food. Even if we eat organic produce, if there's a field nearby in which they're using agrochemicals that drift 7 miles, say, the food you're eating that's, quote, organic may have those chemicals. And when you eat the food, you have no idea what they're going to do to your body. Hence, we have 80% of Americans tested with glyphosate in their urine, in their body. And then if you look at the environment, it's absolutely disgraceful. We are poisoning the world. We have lost 2/3 of all the wild animals on this planet since 1970. This is completely unsustainable. And beyond that, the industrial farming system produces 30 to 40% of greenhouse gases. Again, it's a failed system. It needs transformation, both in the way and manners that the farming process is done, and also in the treatment of its workers.
It is a very pathological system that produces food. Why is it so difficult to change it? What are the factors that it's hurting everybody, including the growers, especially the farm workers? Why is it so difficult to transform this pathological system?
I think the main reason is because the agrochemical companies are making huge profits. And to give you an example, the Environmental Protection Agency has an agency under it called the Department of Pesticide Regulation. And this entity is supposed to regulate pesticides so that they're not harmful to people or the environment. However, their funding comes from the agrochemical companies. So the incentive then is to promote the sale of agrochemicals to fund the Department of Pesticide Regulation. It's a huge conflict of interest. And I'm just shocked and surprised still today that this is even legal in this state.
Wow. So it's legalized oppression.
Yes, it's legalized oppression. Yes. Under the agrochemical companies. That's exactly what it is.
And the harm is affecting everybody, consumers.
Everybody.
The environment.
Everybody. Yes.
And species, you know, of all kinds.
Pardon me?
Species of all kinds.
Yes. That's why we're losing species. We're poisoning the planet. Yeah. And then, you know, the most impacted are farm workers. They are the most exposed to these horrible pesticides. And quite frankly, I can't even talk about it without getting angry, but I have met too many farm worker families with children, with at least one child, if not more, of anomalies related to pesticide exposure in the Watsonville area. Cancer, leukemia, ADHD, autism spectrum syndrome, birth defects, learning disabilities when their parents want them to become educated. All of these factors are increased in the children. So basically, we're stealing their future and throwing them under the bus. They're not treated. This would never happen in a wealthy white community. This is environmental racism.
The systemic institutional exploitation of these people, it's very obvious. They're paying their poverty levels. They create tremendous amounts of wealth.
Yep.
Yet they get very little to nothing.
Yes.
They get a lot of health illnesses and, like you said, cancer, disabilities of all types. So why are they not getting the attention from the larger public?
I think that attention is beginning to grow. I remember when I had my epiphany, I realized that I had been teaching at the college level for many years, and I was equipped to be a speaker and go out and inform the public, which I have been doing. And as I have spread the word, more and more people are spreading the word, and there's more demands being made. And I notice in the legislature, there's more bills being passed that potentially can benefit farm workers. However, I think the ultimate solution has to be the transformation of industrial agriculture to organic, regenerative agricultural practices and more of a cooperative employment situation where farm workers have a chance to actually improve their lives rather than being kept in horrendous poverty. And when I say horrendous poverty, I'm talking about 19 people living in less than 1,000 square feet, I've seen. And they tell me that they have to line up in the morning to use the one bathroom in the facility. So when you ask the question, why don't farm workers' lives matter? For all these reasons, this is no way to treat human beings.
And can you tell us a little bit about the demographics of these farm workers? Who are they? Where do they come from? Are they replacing other people from farm labor historically? Or are these people who have historically been defined as just, sources of exploitable labor?
Yes, basically, and there has been a historical replacement of one ethnic group after the other. We had Chinese laborers for a period of time. They were replaced by Japanese laborers. Those Japanese laborers brought their knowledge of farming from Japan, and many of them have become very successful growers. There's been a Hindu community of farm workers. There's the Filipinos, and now we have the Mexican workers. And I think they've probably been around for one of the longer periods of time. In the central coastal California area where I work, many of the farm workers are from Oaxaca. There are hundreds of them. They're all hiding. They're either hiding where they're living or they're hiding on the farm wherever they're working. You don't see them in groups in the plaza, for instance. And they live with this onus of constant fear of deportation and having their families deported. So the Oaxacan population is huge. And then we have earlier arrivals, mostly from Michoacan and Jalisco, some from Colima, west central Mexico. And then of the Oaxacans, we have Mixteco, Zapoteco, and some Triqui. So those are, at least where in the area I live in, that's the demographics. We do monthly distributions of food, household goods, clothing. We have an acupuncturist. We have a masseuse. We have a chiropractor. We have various services, and we do this work in an alleyway, so farm workers who are not documented can more or less hide. They're not on a major street, in other words.
And so, Gina, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No,
I want to get to that, to your center, in a little bit. But before that, we were talking about the ethnic replacement of various ethnicities working in the fields, originating from colonized labor, forced migrants from Africa for centuries across the Americas.
Right.
And then you bring attention to the end of the Civil War, how there were recruitments of Chinese brought to work in the fields and railroads.
Right.
Later Japanese, Filipinos.
Right.
Asian Indians, and so on. But you mentioned Mexicans as being continuous across time. And one thing that I want to bring attention to is that the term Mexican is a nationality. And that 100 years ago, Manuel Gamio, Paul Taylor, and many other scholars of that historical period of the 30s would refer to these Mexican migrants as largely indigenous and mestizos.
And so
these are communities that, like now, they're being displaced by neoliberalism you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. That is, their ability to produce for themselves has been squashed by the global economy that suppresses their diversified crops, chiles, tomates, calabacitas, squash, corn, to mono production of one crop. And so that places them into migration. So we've seen these locations from historical dislocations. And so in a way, the ethnic replacement thesis, it seems that it's been happening, but there's specific racialized people who appear to have continued to be the main source of labor. And that is Caribbean, Afro-Latinos from the Caribbeans in the east of the U.S., Dominicans, Haitians, and in the Southwest, they remain very Indo-American, very indigenous.
Right.
So I wanted to bring up attention to that. And I want us to go to that topic of your center for farm worker families. But let's take a little pause. And can you tell us about your center for farm worker families?
Okay, we basically the main purpose is to inform the public, and I speak to whoever will listen about these issues. And I'm speaking generally at least once a week, if not more, in various capacities. And then beyond that, we do whatever we can for farm workers. I got a call on my way up here to visit my daughter in the car about a farm worker who has children and no refrigerator. And she's wondering how she can get a refrigerator. I found out recently from an attorney that, the owners of rental units are not required to provide either a stove or a refrigerator for the unit, only heat. So one has to ask how a farm worker family raises a family in a unit with no stove and no refrigerator. So we end up buying a lot of those stoves and refrigerators when people donate. I decided early on that I would do the Center for Farm Worker Families as a volunteer, as long as the community supported us financially. And up to date, they have more than supported us. In fact, during the pandemic, the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County literally gave us thousands and thousands of dollars to give farm workers rental assistance so they would not be removed from their units for lack of pay because they couldn't work. Beyond that, we when I visited a Oaxacan family about 3 or 4 years ago, I was talking with the parents, and they had two young girls who were crying for food, and they kept crying and the parents did nothing. And I finally was so disturbed by this, I said, stop the conversation and said, give them some food. And the farm workers looked down at the ground like they were ashamed. And I walked over to their refrigerator and opened it. And I will never forget. They had one head of lettuce, a third a gallon of milk, and two Jell-O cups. And I said, where is your food? And they said, we're not working. We don't have money to buy food. So everyone's hungry. We're all hungry. And I told him, I said, well, we don't do that here. So we called the food bank, and that afternoon they brought out food for 144 families. So since then, that gave rise to the distributions, and we're partnered now with the Second Harvest Food Bank, and they bring us enough food for however many families are signed up to come to the distributions. And the distributions have grown. I mean, we've even had three COVID clinics, flu vaccine clinics. We had a group of optometrists come and check eye quality or vision for farm workers, and even provided them glasses for free if they needed lenses. We have the food, we have household goods. The thing that goes the fastest are diapers in size 5 and 6 and baby wipes. That's what we need the most of. So that's one thing we do, is the distributions monthly on the second Friday of the month. Then I do farm worker reality tours. And I take groups of people, usually school groups or writing groups, to actually meet farm workers in three different locations and to hear the stories I've been hearing for many, many years. And I think that that's got to be one of the most impactful things, because it's one thing to read about it or to hear about it, but to actually meet the farm workers and hear their stories is very impactful. And then a third program we've recently developed is called Bridging the Digital Divide. And we have computers donated, and we educate 6 farm workers at a time in how to use a computer in my office. And then as they practice in the office, then at the end of the session, we give them the computers to take home and also a phone number where they can call and get internet for free. So these are some of our programs, but anytime, and we're going to start a tutoring program in the library, Watsonville Library, where we'll have tutors available on the weekends, and any farm workers can come, or children can come and get assistance with their assignments. So these are some of the things that we're doing. And then beyond that, we're advocates. We're very strong advocates for justice. And that's why I wrote this article about why don't farm workers' lives matter? Because in Santa Cruz County, in the last 6 months, we had a Black Lives Matter sign in the middle of town, and 2 people came along and destroyed it. And they were taken to court. They got penalties. They were going to have to pay a fine. They would have to do community work, sensitivity training, etc. And then within a week of that incident and their accountability hearing, I got a call from a woman in the fields who was hysterical, absolutely hysterical, sobbing. She had just been raped in the field. And UC Davis and Southern Poverty Law Center claims that 60 to 80% of farm worker women are sexually harassed, groped, or outright raped in the field. And she was one of them. Then within 2 or 3 days during that heat wave we had, I got other calls from farm workers about the fact that people were fainting in the field because it was 101 to 108 degrees and the supervisor would not let them go. And it's like I tell people, the laws are on the books against these things. You can't rape farm workers legally. You can't, you're not supposed to keep them in the field past a reasonable temperature. And yet the laws are not upheld. So why don't farm workers matter? That's if these kids that destroyed the Black Lives Matter banner could be brought to account. Why can't people that rape farm workers or keep them in the field to the point where they're fainting, why aren't they brought to account? And I get calls all the time about farm workers calling me saying they're spraying pesticides near us and people are feeling dizzy, fainting, vomiting, et cetera. And then I call the agricultural commissioner, who then sends a team out to investigate. But unfortunately, the farm workers won't talk because they're worried about being blacklisted or deported. And until we take this onus of deportation off their shoulders, I don't think we're going to get justice for farm workers. That's all anyone needs to do is threaten them with that.
Wow. And the historical systemic dehumanization of colonized people, forced migrants from Africa who remain unfree. And then the colonized indigenous people who remain in the fields are continuously seen as outsiders to the nation.
Yes.
Being within the U.S. nation, they were the last ones to attain citizenship in 1924. And Mexicans were seen at that time as generally indigenous people. Therefore, even if legally classified as white, they were not treated as such. And they were also segregated on the basis of their indigeneity. So it's, historical systemic oppressions that require dehumanizing people.
Yes.
And like you said, an effective way has been of viewing them as outsiders, that's illegal, that's less than human.
Right.
And so, it is a big struggle to combat those top-down depictions of these people who are foundational to the making of this nation.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I have a personal story that can go along with that. And that is that I grew up in Southern California at a time when it was illegal for races to marry. And so my father is Mexican, my mother is white. And when I tried to go to school in a white school, it was absolutely horrific. I mean, I didn't have friends. People would call me names. The teachers were cruel to me. It was terrible. And this is one reason I became a biologist. I have 2 degrees in biology because I could run in the hills above my home in Altadena and make friends with all the animals there and got very close to the plants. And really the natural world, living world, was my only solace at that time. And luckily, I'm glad those laws have finally changed. But at the time, what you did with a person like me was try to make them white. So I was not allowed to learn Spanish. I was not allowed to stay out in the sun too long. I couldn't wear braids because I looked too, quote, Indian, et cetera, et cetera. And it was like a form of abuse where a major part of my identity was stolen. And it wasn't until I actually went to Colombia, South America, when I was in my 20s, that I felt like I finally got that piece back. I was whole again. But I'm hoping that that's not still going on, where people are raising kids that are mixed race and denying a whole part of their ethnicity. It's cruel.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that traumatic story.
And, yes.
Yes. My heart goes to you. And sadly, this oppression of identities that have been historically stigmatized are so widespread and continue. Yes. And we see how indigenous groups right now are being Mexicanized or Latinized through the, you know, in, like in those areas that you're, that where you work, the coastal, central coast.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of indigenous communities, and in schools, the more Mexicanized kids sometimes put down the more indigenous children,
right.
who
right.
then feel pressure to assimilate into more mainstream cultures, whether Mexican right. or Americanized.
Right.
And it is, yes, it's tragic. We need more education at all levels to be inclusive and to be affirming of our beautiful diversity that we have in this, you know, in this world. Let me ask you, I mean, it seems that it's been historical, structural lax policies that are the new forms of enslavement, denying people access to health coverage, workers' comp, you know, even if you were legal, you know, you were denied workers' comp, unemployment insurance, minimum wage or extra time. And there's been struggles to access, you know, those benefits that every other worker has, because right. These farm workers are in occupations that have been historically racialized, you know.
Right.
And so what are the policies that you feel that can help us combat these unequal treatment that remains so unfair? Are there any policies that you recommend for us to support? Are there any policies or programs that you encourage us to combat? Like, for example, the guest worker program is one that it's that is formal in our times, and it was combated aggressively when it was enacted during World War II up to the 60s. It was sort of ended because it was seen as a system too close to slavery or like slavery. Now we have formalized it again. You know, any thoughts about that?
Yes, I do have thoughts. Number one, we must have comprehensive immigration reform. I don't care who's in Congress, Republicans, Democrats, whoever, we must take this burden off the shoulders of farm workers. Anyone who has worked weeks, months, and years in the field should not be worried about deportation. We're lucky to have them here, and they need to be recognized as such. So that's number one. Number two, they need a living wage. We should not have to give them charity when they're working so hard and feeding the nation. They should be able to earn a decent wage if it means the state kicks in some money or it means we pay higher food prices, whatever it takes. We need a living wage for all farm workers. And finally, we need a contract with the growers. Right now, 22% of farm workers have their wages stolen. So they go to work a week or up to a season even, and the grower won't pay them. And if the farm worker goes and tries to find an attorney who'll take the case, the first thing the attorney asks for is a contract, to view a contract. And if there's no contract, then there's nothing that can be done. So they're essentially victimized on a horrific level. So I think those three things would transform farm workers' lives right away and give them some power in their situation. As long as they're undocumented, as long as they're impoverished and have no contract, then basically they're just a fodder for the growers to use for their own greed and benefit. And that's what growers have always looked for, is a docile workforce that won't rebel, won't unionize, etc. And that's what they have with these policies not rectified.
And wow, thank you. These are great recommendations for policies. Comprehensive immigration reform, living wages, and enforced contracts.
Yes.
Beginning yes. and enforced contracts, promises.
That's what everybody else has. I'm quote legal. I get a decent wage. If I work for someone, I sign a contract. Why can't farm workers do that? Why is it that we view them as such an underclass? They're not even worthy of a contract or a living wage. It makes me furious. I'm sorry. I can't talk about it without getting angry.
Well, I share your anger. This has been a great presentation. I'm sure that we're going to have more discussions on this very important topic. Until we see change, we will continue this topic. Yes. I want to thank you, Dr. Lopez. Thank you greatly for your work, your mind, your heart, and may your spirit of human rights touch everyone listening to this talk. Thank you for listening. We hope our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all. If you just listen to the Building Justice podcast, the information contained in this podcast represents the views and opinions of the hosts and guests and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Sacramento State or Chris J.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for building justice. Building justice. Time.